Welcome to the WCVE Political Forum. I'm Craig Carper.
And I'm Saraya Wintersmith.
Tonight we're going to discuss this year's election results, the ongoing power struggle for the control of the House of Delegates, and how this new dynamic affects Governor-elect Ralph Northam's agenda.
We have a panel of experts with us tonight. First, we have Jeff Shapiro. Jeff is a political columnist for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, where he has been working since 1979.
Approximately.
Jeff also joins us on 88.9 FM Friday mornings to discuss the week in Virginia politics. And Dr. Quentin Kidd is a political science professor and director of the Wasson Center for Public Policy at Christopher Newport University. And I understand you're celebrating a 10-year anniversary.
Of the Wasson Center.
Exactly. But you've been there 21 years. Learned a lot about each other recently.
And Dr. Robbie Perry is chair and associate professor of political science at VCU, Virginia Commonwealth University, where he's been teaching for 3 years. He's also working on a book that introduces the lives and campaigns of black and openly lesbian and gay elected officials in the United States.
Welcome to all of you. On Election Day, Democrats showed up in huge numbers in Virginia, leading to a statewide sweep for governor, lieutenant governor, and attorney general. And in the House, Democrats started the day with a 34-seat minority, and by the end of the night had picked up 15 seats, significantly narrowing the Republican majority of 66 seats. Was all this a backlash to the policies of Donald Trump, or was there something more happening? Jeff, we can start with you.
The election clearly took place against this great big blonde, red-tied, dark blue-suited backdrop called Donald Trump. Virginia, if only by accident of geography, of course, is hard by Washington, D.C., particularly in the eastern half of the state where the economy is its strongest, where the votes are most abundant. The lines that often distinguish federal, state, local, and regional politics tend to disappear. So when the President of the United States attempts to close the borders of a multi-huge state to Muslims, it has an immediate and measurable effect. When the President of the United States talks about imposing a freeze on federal hiring, that has an immediate and measurable effect on Virginia. When he threatens a shutdown of the federal government to squeeze money from Democrats to build a wall on the southern border, it has an immediate and measurable impact on Virginia. And when white supremacists descend on Charlottesville to protest the possible removal of a statue of Robert E. Lee and the President of the United States defends them, that has an immediate and measurable impact on a state in which race has always been a factor in politics, but now is a much more complex factor in our politics, given that Virginians are not just black or white, they're yellow, they're brown as well.
Dr. Perry.
Jeff is right, except I would also add that I think this story that we saw last week is also told not just because of backlash to Trump, but also it demonstrates the grassroots power of a lot of progressive organizations and nonprofit groups, both in the state and nationally, that began to organize effectively and recruit candidates to run for office. And this is obvious, for example, in that most of the incumbent Republican men that lost throughout the Commonwealth of Virginia last week lost to Democratic women. Women have decided that not only the election of Donald Trump is something that they find to be objectionable, but throughout the Commonwealth of Virginia, they've answered the call from these progressive organizations and these left organizations that have been working ever since last year's election to ensure that state and local elections are actually being heavily paid attention to by Democrats. Because as we know, Republicans have been doing this very well over the entire last 15 years or so, where they have now controlled two-thirds of state legislatures and state executive mansions with governors. And that actually creates a real problem for Democrats in any effort to change local and state issues that really matter to Democratic voters. And so, yes, I think it's partly a response to Trump, but I also think it's a great response that our Virginian decided to actually accept the encouragement by these organizations that were nonprofits, both in the state and national, to actually run for office. What we saw last week was an exciting opportunity where dozens of new people ran for office the first time, and they won.
Dr. Kidd.
So a 10,000-foot perspective, a focus on women. I'll just close this with an anecdote. On election day afternoon, I was in the grocery store, ran into a friend of mine. Didn't really know, I've never known what his politics were, but we started talking about the election. He asked me what I thought would happen. And he said, you know, he said, my wife, I think, voted straight ticket Republican today, and straight ticket Democratic today, and she's normally a Republican voter. And I said, you know, what, so does that surprise you? And he said, well, when she left this morning, she indicated she was going to vote for Ralph Northam, but I assumed that she would vote for Republicans. And when we came back at lunch, we were sitting around the table at lunch, and she said she voted straight ticket. And he said, you mean you didn't vote for Northam? And she said, no, I voted straight ticket Democratic. I got into the voting booth, and I decided I was so angry at Trump, I was not going to vote for any Republicans. And I think that played out in thousands of voting booths across Virginia on Election Day. And that is in part where that sweep comes from that swept all of those House of Delegates members out and all of those new House of Delegates members in, many of them women who had never run for office before.
There was also talk of a rising American electorate, women, millennials, minorities. How did those demographics play into the big wins for Democrats?
Well, they're there. If you look at the exit polls, they're there. Oddly enough, though, voter turnout was up amongst Republicans and amongst Democrats. It was just up larger amongst Democrats. Look, Ed Gillespie got the second highest number of votes that any governor running had ever gotten in Virginia. It's just that Ralph Northam got more. So turnout was up amongst partisans on both sides. And it isn't necessarily demographic change. I mean, I think Chesterfield probably can be explained with some demographic change. But you know, turnout was up in blue areas amongst Democrats. It was up in red areas amongst Republicans. It's just that there are far more people who live in blue areas than there are who live in red areas today. And so it really isn't a demographic story as much as it's an energy and a surge story. But there are pockets in Virginia, Chesterfield County, is one. Chesapeake and Hampton Roads, Virginia Beach a little bit is a demographic change kind of story, but largely it's a surge story.
I wonder too if, and we discussed this earlier, that none of us are from Virginia. We're all come-heres. And the majority of people who live in Virginia are come-heres, 52% and change. And it means that our electorate, even when deciding state office and local office, is perhaps more national in its temperament. And this has, I think, tends to, you know, kind of strengthen the partisan reflex of voters. And that was very much on display in the Virginia election. We often talk about how, you know, those elections are decided in the middle. Well, the so-called independent vote is clearly starting to shrink in Virginia. You know, you're either one or the other, your fish or fowl.
But I do think the demographics actually matter. And this is why, because in order to be a Democrat to win in the South or in the Midwest now, and statewide in particular, you have to win metropolitan areas. Who actually lives in metropolitan areas? Single white women, millennials, and African Americans. We wouldn't be talking about this election today being a wave of Democratic victories if it really weren't for Black and African American women.
In particular, and the exit poll demonstrates that in big numbers.
Yeah, there was a much more robust minority turnout in this election. I think 30-something percent, depending on whose exit poll one believes. I think as well, though, we can't rule out the dispirited Republican vote. Yeah, there were more Republican voters, but there were a lot of Republican voters who were wondering where their party had gone. And a lot of these voters were casting votes for Ralph Northam, largely because Ralph Ed Gillespie, who was by every conceivable measure an establishment, large E, establishment Republican, chose basically in those last 10 days or so to run as a large D deplorable.
And since we were talking about demographics, the one that I don't think we mentioned was LGBTQ. We've got our first elected transgender delegate now. Overcoming, Danica Rome defeated a 20-some year incumbent Republican, one of the most conservative members of the legislature, Bob Marshall. What led to this sea change?
Bob Marshall is probably in the 10th circle of hell right now. You didn't know there were 10, that you thought there were only 9, but he's probably discovered he lost to the very kind of person, the person that he spent his career running against. It's a phenomenal election, that particular election.
But on the other hand, it's actually not surprising. Danica Rome ran a campaign that was effective, where she made it clear who she was from the beginning. Voters appreciate trust. When you run as an openly LGBTQ candidate, you have to come out from the beginning. Otherwise, voters will determine you to be untrustworthy. She came out from the very beginning that she's a transgender woman, so that issue was off the table immediately. And then what did she do? She focused the whole campaign on Route 28 and transportation issues, which is what actually matters to voters in that district. And when what she proved is that when you actually run on the issues, no matter what your ascriptive characteristics might be, you win, and she did it.
Danica Rome was also local talent. Prince William County is Danica Rome's home. This is where she grew up. This is where she made friends. This is where she had a career as a newspaper reporter. So Danica Rome was a known quantity, even in a bustling and fast-changing place like Prince William, before Danica Rome was a candidate.
And we saw lots of money, particularly outside money, some in-state money, but a lot of outside money flowing into both campaigns, much of that money paying for negative ads. How did these two things affect the results we saw on Tuesday a couple weeks back?
I saw a number that said about $1.5 million a week in the last 8 weeks of the campaign in outside money on TV alone. Unfortunately, we're in a public television studio right now. Commercial TV made out. In this election. I think what it amounted to is it energized the bases of both parties. Negative advertising tends to energize your base and suppress the sort of undecided middle. There wasn't much of an undecided middle, and so it had the opposite effect of energizing each other's base, I think pretty effectively.
And remember, Virginia has this odd political calendar. It and New Jersey were the only states holding statewide gubernatorial elections. The outcome in New Jersey was never in doubt. Virginia is the purple swing state, looked like the ultimate battleground, one in which either party could prevail. And so that directed, or as a result, that meant there would be even more national money pumped into this state.
You're listening to the WCBE News Political Forum with Jeff Shapiro, Dr. Ravi Perry, and Dr. Quentin Kidd. I'm Saraya Wintersmith, co-moderating this panel with Craig Carper.
I would add that we might not have seen those negative ads had a Democrat won last year for the president, in this case Hillary Clinton, in that obviously she would have appointed someone that would have given Democrats and liberals a 5-4 majority on the Supreme Court and likely would have overturned Citizens United. That did not happen. And so negative ads still work and outside money can still pour in. You never know where the money is from. The problem for the Gillespie campaign was that when you start using the last 2 weeks in particular, race baiting ads that really echo back the days of Willie Horton, then those negative ads actually lose.
Guillermo Horton.
Right, yes. Yeah, right, yes, exactly.
But don't you think Ed Gillespie would have been running against Hillary Clinton if she had been sitting in the White House?
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. But I think the challenge here for us is that we got to remember that ads are negative, and when they work, they work. But when they don't work, they backfire. And that's exactly what happened, I think, this time in the last. I mean, Gillespie ran a great campaign, really, until about the last 2 weeks.
Well, look, we were tracking this election in our polling from middle September through the Friday before Election Day. When the MS-13 ad hit, we could see Republican intending voters backing away. We saw no backing away of Democratic voters, people who were supporting Northam, but we saw a dip in Gillespie's numbers, at least temporarily. And I think that was that's the backfiring of this. In polling, a lot of times, the way you can tell whether a partisan's supporters are uncomfortable with what the candidate is doing is they'll often say, "I'm undecided in how I'm going to vote." So we saw an increase in undecided for three or four nights for Gillespie when those MS-13 ads hit. That indicated to me that Republican voters were uncomfortable with it, and Democratic voters weren't depressed by it. And I think that ultimately backfired on Gillespie. It didn't do ultimately what he was hoping it would do.
Don't you think as well that the biographies were important? Ed Gillespie was the ultimate swamp creature, you know, the lobbyist. Ralph Northam was, you know, a pediatrician. If you can't trust the president, you can't trust your pastor, you can always trust your kid's pediatrician.
I mean, no, I think that's a fair point. Yeah, that's exactly true. Right. Which is why I think Ed Gillespie, whenever he could, would tell you about his biography. Mm-hmm. You know, going to work in his family's grocery store when he was young, et cetera, because he was trying, it was essentially humanizing himself and deflecting from the idea that he was just a lobbyist, just a political hack, because he was faced with an opponent who, it's hard to not like your doctor.
I want to pivot now to the House. Right now we're uncertain exactly what the makeup is going to be. As of this taping, election results are still uncertified. We know that there's at least one legal battle out in the 28th district. If Democrats are successful, it'd be one of the few times in modern history that we see a flip or a power sharing agreement. Do any of y'all have any insight about how that might work or what that might look like?
Well,
if they're successful.
And you know, as reporters, I'm sure you're running into the same thing that I've run into, that normally very talkative Republicans and Democrats aren't. It seems that many have gone to ground trying to figure out, you know, what's going on. Kirk Cox, for example, the presumed Republican speaker, there's that false title that has been, you know, concocted for him that the Republicans have used, you know, speaker designate or something. The last time we heard from him, it was this very feisty statement in which he said he was certain that the Republican majority was secure, albeit reduced, and that, you know, he anticipated serving as speaker, and he needed your money to help make sure that that actually occurred. What's happened since is that other Republicans have emerged as possible candidates for speakers, suggesting that certainly within this dramatically reduced caucus, there's a lot of uncertainty how to proceed.
Yeah. How power sharing would work is uncertain right now. Because the last experience with power sharing, I think both Democrats and Republicans walked away unhappy with, thinking that it didn't work really well. So there is actually some sense that if it ends up being 50-50, some sort of ceremonial speaker is essentially elected, and there's an agreement that the fights are going to happen at the committee level, and that it won't be a speaker directing those fights, but it'll happen at the committee level. I mean, that's all speculation at this point. If it's 51-49 on either side, it's a moot point. But a 50-50 House would be a 50-50 House with at least 15 or 16 new people, 11 or 12 of them who never have so much as served on a board of any kind. And they're still trying to find out, you know, where their office is and what their email address is and all that. It would be a chaotic situation at best at a year where we've got to decide a $110 billion budget.
So you're talking about a position much kind of like the lieutenant governor.
Yes, yeah, so, sort of like. It would have to be a member of the House of Delegates, but somebody who would essentially agree just to make sure that it functions. But any controversies, any fights would agree to be had out at the committee level.
Regardless of the outcome, this is good news for the Democrats, because they, of course, did not expect to be in this position. As we've all said, no one expected them to be in this position. And so as long as this drags out, it's actually good for the Democrats. It keeps the news and the attention of their historic win from last week on the front page. And that is great for fundraising. It's great for encouraging other candidates to run. It's great for actually giving them the momentum that they need internally to fight some of those recounts and those lawsuits. And they, of course, wanted to end up in their favor so they can take control of the House. And so either way, this is bad for the GOP and in this Commonwealth of Virginia. It's good for Democrats, too.
But if you're Ralph Northam and your job is to serve as the chief executive and you have a program that you want to implement and you have really no grasp of the landscape, this is there's great uncertainty here for the next governor. It might have been, if it had been, say, a 52 Republican, 48 Democrat outcome, it might be a little bit easier to navigate. Mm-hmm. There might have been on things such as Medicaid expansion, that might be, you know, a little bit easier lift. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, who knows? And over on the Senate, there's a single seat separating the parties, so there's that complexity as well. So this is a handful for Ralph Northam, even as an experienced legislator and a former lieutenant, soon to be former lieutenant governor.
You anticipated my next question, but I think you kind of answered it a bit, which was, now that the election is over, it's time to govern. What are we likely to see from the Northam administration? It sounds complicated. But let's talk about maybe a few issues. Several people in our audience asked about Medicaid expansion. You alluded to it. Even with, you know, Ralph Northam's ideal legislature, there's still uncertainty in Washington.
It's not that they forget, but you got to understand, Medicaid expansion is really just asking the federal government to waive the normal rules. And so for the last 3 years, the McAuliffe administration has, for the first 2 years of their term and last year, they've desperately wanted Medicaid expansion, knowing that the Obama administration would immediately grant the request. So the irony of ironies may be that the Democrats get what they've wanted for the last 4 years, only to have the Trump administration say, we're not going to grant the waiver, because that's what it would require. The Trump administration would have to grant the waiver to allow Medicaid to expand in Virginia.
And given how the Trump administration has been less than interested in advising people that, for example, right now you could be signing up for a so-called Obamacare during this enrollment period, they aren't doing that. The Republican Trump administration is not interested in letting people know that. And despite that, though, the enrollment numbers have actually increased. People are actually enrolling, because healthcare is the core issue that matters to Virginians and obviously Americans everywhere. And so, and I absolutely agree that it's unlikely that the Trump administration is going to in any way allow the waiver to actually be passed and accept it. And that essentially means that, you know, Democrats are in a bind. And ideally, what that would likely mean for, if you are a Democrat, it would mean that it would give some indication that 2018 is likely to be a mirror of what happened last week as they wait for another opportunity to solidify some of their opportunities, such as with healthcare.
Talk a little bit about policies that we might see die now.
Oh, yes. on the killing room floor, as they say. The departing speaker, Bill Howell, felt very strongly about overhauling the manner in which Virginia provides pensions for its retired employees. I suspect there's a pretty good chance that's not going to happen. There were a lot of concerns expressed about the speaker's certainly perceived interest in moving full on to a 401k type program for the state workforce, or believing that it was a far less expensive program for taxpayers. In the Richmond area, that's a very sensitive issue. I don't think that's going anywhere. You know, an element of the healthcare debate has been regulation of the healthcare industry in Virginia. You know, when we talk about this, we talk about COPN, Certificates of Public Need. Essentially, the state government has a veto over the expansion of a hospital or the acquisition of equipment. Conservative Republicans in the legislature feel very strongly about doing away with this system entirely. And what it has really done over many years, almost a half century now, is it's sort of guaranteed markets for healthcare providers. COPN reform, as those who would like to do away with the system entirely call it, I think is pretty much dead too.
And then do we anticipate any movement on guns now?
That's a good question. A question that has been asked to me a lot in the last week is how quickly I anticipate these new Democrats bringing their issues to the legislative body through bills, and I'm not of the mind that we're going to see really quick reform measures come out of these 15, 16 new legislatures. I think that they're going to. I'm of the mind that Ralph Northam is going to, and his people and the more senior Democrats in the General Assembly are gonna encourage a more slow, methodical effort on the part of these new legislators to introduce their pet projects. And many didn't run on a lot of left progressive things. A lot of them ran on basic bread and butter things, transportation, education. So I don't think we're going to see a lot of real left reform legislation. Are we going to see some stuff on guns? Perhaps. Are we going to see stuff on right to work? Perhaps. Are we going to see legislation to increase the minimum wage? Perhaps. But this is stuff that had been introduced already over the last several years. It's not completely new. The difference is it may get more attention this time.
Is the reaction of the remaining Republicans, and most of them are in these gerrymandered districts that have strong Republican reflexes, will that compel them to sort of revert to form? Will they be forced to be as tough and aggressive given the base, or are they in a position maybe to be a little bit more accommodating?
So if what
always
I've heard,
one step ahead, Jeff.
If what I've heard about the distaste and the lack of interest in power sharing is any indication, I think both sides are going to go to their corners and fight.
You're listening to the WCBE News Political Forum with Jeff Shapiro, Dr. Ravi Perry, and Dr. Quentin Kidd. I'm Saraya Wintersmith, co-moderating this panel with Craig Carper.
Yeah, I would definitely expect that. I mean, the GOP nationally has not really allowed establishment and moderate members of the party to gain any sway or any attention. And they also have been bruised, actually, when they have attempted to do so, which has resulted in a large number of early resignations and announcements about that, of them not wanting to run for re-election. And so I think that is going to be reflected here, obviously, in Virginia as well, where the party is going to stay strong with their base, because there is a belief that that base is what really is going to drive a new kind of GOP voters, because the Trump election really was effective at that. And they believe, particularly the Bannon wing of the party, they believe, and all of their supporters here in Virginia, that that is actually a winning recipe for the GOP in an era where these diverse coalitions from the Democrats actually results in a lot of successes for them.
Dr. Kidd, you were alluding to a lot of different kitchen table issues, transportation, other things. What do we do at our kitchen tables? We balance our
budgets.
I believe you had a budget question.
Just how might the new members, if you don't see them pushing a whole lot of new legislation, do you anticipate that it'll be the same with how they handle this more than $100 billion budget?
There's just not a lot of discretionary spending that goes on. I mean, $110 billion is a lot of money. The vast majority of it is already spoken for. It's really a question of tinkering around the edges on, you know, do you increase a little bit in education? Do you, you know, where do you cut, et cetera? Most of it's spoken for. So there's not, the odd thing is that it's a budget year. There's a lot of work to be done. But a lot of it is, there's not a lot of choice. You know, federal health care money is passed through, but it's got to be legislatively passed through. You're not going to radically change education funding from year to year. Every public school board member out there would, you know, go crazy over something like that. Mm-hmm. So there's not a lot of discretion, mm-hmm. to be quite honest with you.
Well, actually, this is one of the reasons Medicaid expansion has always been so appealing, and even privately to a number of Republicans who are in the business of writing the state's budget. Medicaid is the fastest growing expense of state government. Certainly it's the growth in that bill. If Virginia could sponge up the billions that the government is prepared to share, that would minimize some of the pressure on other aspects of the budget, and maybe, you know, make it easier for Virginia to put more money into higher education, more in terms of direct dollars, and maybe taking some of the pressure off the boards of visitors and the leaders of these schools who are, you know, pushing for tuition increases to make up for the unreliable funding out of Richmond. Now, that may not mean a lot to new junior legislators, but it means a lot, you know, to the dozen or so senior legislators who sit as members of the House Appropriations Committee and the Senate Finance Committee, who have to come up with a compromise budget, who will be working in league with the Democratic administration. There's something else here, and that is this great big question mark that is, you know, federal funding in general. Does Virginia have to endure another sequestration? That's a very fancy word for automatic across-the-board spending cuts. It wasn't until this past year that Virginia sort of emerged from that experience of two-plus years ago. So there are a lot of question marks, fiscal question marks, that Virginia faces. And that's one of the reasons why the credit rating agencies, in particular Standard and Poor's, are maybe a little less bullish on our highest possible credit rating.
What we do know is that the budget is is what we know is what's not going to happen now because of the changes in the House of Delegates. And so what we know is that money is not going to be spent, for example, on saving Confederate monuments. We know that money is not going to be spent, for example, on pushing efforts to not give LGBTQ people employment security in terms of not being fired simply because of who they are. These types of issues, I think, help people understand that why we should care about the budget, and because now while most voters might not understand how the details work, I think many people are content with the fact that they know that given the constituency of the House of Delegates now, the money that is spent on some of the social kind of issues is not going to be spent in a way that's derogatory toward certain sectors of the Virginia population.
Maybe a nerdy, kind of wonky question for those of us who follow these things closely. But Jeff, I think you alluded to this. Several senior members of the House Appropriations Committee were not reelected, including those. One of those locally was Delegate John O'Bannon. How does Richmond Henrico, where he hailed from, and other areas who lost members, how do they lose out in the budget process, and how do other areas gain?
Well, you know, ultimately, legislative bodies are about seniority. You know, you have to stick around to accumulate power, and then you want to stick around even longer so you can really exercise it. John O'Bannon did that as a member of the Appropriations Committee. And of course, he was in a somewhat delicate position as a health care provider himself, and his resistance on Medicaid expansion, some of us jokingly would refer to him as Dr. No, became an issue in his campaign. His opponent said that O'Bannon had betrayed his own patients by refusing to go along with Medicaid expansion. Set aside the rhetoric for a minute. The fact that someone as senior as John O'Bannon in a seniority-driven system isn't going to be around isn't good for the Richmond area. We also lost Manoli LaPosse, a more moderate Republican who represented the west end of the city and down into Chesterfield County, parts of Henrico. I think it's safe to say that for the most part, Manoli LaPosse is one of those Republicans who believes in life after birth. When his caucus was, you know, desperately and very publicly fighting the election of an openly gay man to a judgeship in Richmond, Manoli LaPosse was out there fighting to make sure that this openly gay man indeed became a judge. He has sat as a senior member of the Courts Committee, in particular the subcommittee of the Courts Committee that vets judicial candidates. His absence is going to be missed for the area, and it's also going to have some impact on that very Byzantine, very dark process for choosing judges, particularly if it's a 50-50 house.
Given the part-time nature of our legislature and the one-term nature of our governor, effectively this is kind of like the re-election of a governor in the sense that, you know, it's a Democratic administration succeeding a Democratic administration.
Probably see some of the same faces.
Probably see, yeah. So the backbone of the administration is probably going to remain pretty consistent over the transition. Now, you know, people will leave over the next year and go on to other things, but you're going to see a lot of the, you know, deputy level and below people that kind of stick around for a while. The cabinet level appointments will change and that kind of stuff. So in some ways, the bureaucracy and the infrastructure at the executive branch level is sort of empowered a little bit in the context of a legislature that has lost a lot of senior members with a lot of institutional memory and been replaced by people who have almost no experience, many of them no experience. And so that's going to empower the bureaucracy and the executive branch a little bit for a short period of time, not anything long term. But to Jeff's point, a lot of senior people who are gone, their institutional memory is gone with them. Mm.
In political science, in some of my, in our introductory classes, I often teach the power and the politics of non-decision making. Stuff that doesn't make the news, things that are not decided, for example, and the impact that that has on our daily lives. Having senior Republicans no longer on committees in the Richmond area that have an impact on what our judgeships look like in the region is actually good news for most of the Richmond area that actually are people of color, and that the types of judges that most GOP members would support at the state and local level are judges that tend to treat persons of color in disparaging ways, hence all the national, international movements in that area. So while we lose the power of being able to kind of yield and wield some of our influence, given having a regional kind of representative on these committees, at the same time, we also kind of prevent certain tragedies from happening by ensuring that certain judges are actually not confirmed.
You're listening to the WCBE News Political Forum with Jeff Shapiro, Dr. Ravi Perry, and Dr. Quentin Kidd. I'm Saraya Wintersmith, co-moderating this panel with Craig Carper.
Coming out of an election cycle that many say was a clear rejection of President Trump and his policies and agenda, what does this mean for the 2018 Senate race, where a Trump sound-alike, Corey Stewart, among others, hope to challenge Democratic Senator Tim Kaine?
As somebody who studies elections, I relish, I'll probably dream about the Republican primary fight between E.W. Jackson and Corey Stewart. it'll just be so fun to watch. Maybe it'll have a moderate in it like a Barbara Comstock, but the real action will be with those two. I don't see the dynamics fundamentally changing. Donald Trump is going to be in the White House still, and the dynamics, the larger macro dynamics that shaped this last election are probably going to be there in 2018 as well. I think Virginia is structurally anywhere from a 1-point to a 5-point Democratic state, all things being equal, not in a wave year, but every year is not a wave year. I mean, I think we're probably a 1 to 4 or 5 point structurally Democratic state right now. I think we can say right now, going into 2018, Tim Kaine has the advantage. The question is, as we were discussing earlier, in politics, a year or two is a lifetime. What happens between now and then? A lot of things can happen to change that dynamic, but I think we start structurally with a dynamic that gives Tim Kaine a slight advantage. Let's see what happens in the Republican primary, who the Republicans nominate, and what happens in Congress and Washington in the next year.
If there is this somewhat, dare one say, sort of clownish Republican primary, if it is indeed a Corey Stewart, E.W. Jackson show, there's no doubt that Kaine would have the advantage. But these can be difficult campaigns for sound and strong incumbents, in that if you have an opponent who seems incapable of achieving certain basic levels of credibility, and that includes putting together an organization, raising money, it can be difficult to run a campaign. Ask Chuck Robb when he ran against Maurice Dawkins in 1988. Ask Mark Warner when he ran against Jim Gilmore for the Senate. These campaigns are almost sort of reduced to shadow boxing and can be draining in another respect. Kaine, of course, is one of those candidates who recognizes that there are many areas of the state that are hostile to Democrats. He's always practiced the politics intended to at least limit the damage in those areas. So this is why he goes into Carroll County with his harmonica on Saturday night and makes bluegrass music. He just wants to kind of create the impression that he may be a Democrat, but he's he's maybe not that threatening after all.
I do think Kane's going to have some challenges next year, partly because some of the criticisms he got as a vice presidential candidate was that he wasn't sexy enough. And despite being fluent in Spanish, and despite what many local Richmonders know about his commitments to various issues, that message did not get out. And vis-a-vis a rather bombastic Republican primary and the energy that's going to be associated with that, and also the effective way in which Republicans are good at narrowing down complex issues to 140 characters and winning at that. Kane is not very good at that. And so if people in any way are influenced by media and how effective one is at actually championing issues, I do think Kane has some work to do to remind people of some of the efforts he's actually accomplished, and he's going to have to really be a candidate who is aggressive and can really tell people a very positive message that can encourage them to actually come out and vote for him, not just against him and against his opponent. And that I think is going to be a real challenge for him based on his performance as a vice presidential candidate.
And Dr. Kidd, you mentioned Barbara Comstock in the 10th Congressional District and Taylor in the 2nd also. I think these are districts where Northern got a majority of votes. Are they going to be hard for Republicans to hold on
well,
to?
Well, look, in this last election, Ralph Northam won those districts. The 2nd Congressional District in Northern Virginia, Barbara Comstock sits in it. The 10th in Northern Virginia, the 2nd in Hampton Roads in Virginia Beach that Scott Taylor sits in. But he came very close in the 7th as well, mm-hmm. Dave Bratt's district. And so I would imagine that Democrats are going to put up, the 10th is probably the most competitive of those races. The 2nd would be the second most competitive, and then the 7th. I'd imagine those are going to be highly contested, hotly contested, you know, who knows where it goes. Democrats feel really good about the 10th, which is why you hear Barbara Comstock's name floated as a possible moderate candidate relative to Corey Stewart as a Republican candidate for Senate. Of course, who knows what she'll do.
But Barbara Comstock is also a survivor. Remember, she was reelected as a Republican in Northern Virginia when Donald Trump was losing her district by double digits. Next year is an off year. Turnout will fall. That could give Barbara Comstock a fighting chance. And again, someone who's a demonstrated fighter. And there are now 9 candidates for the Democratic nomination in the 10th Congressional District. So I think there's probably going to be some winnowing out of that field first.
Mm-hmm. There's one state legislative election left before the next redistricting in 2021. How will the outcome of the 2019 race, as well as pending U.S. Supreme Court case and a Virginia case, affect how our districts are drawn?
Fire away.
So, Governor-elect Northam has claimed that he supports redistricting reform. A fascinating question for me is, after this 2019 round of legislative races, let's just play a hypothetical game. Let's assume that Democrats control both the State House and the State Senate and the Governor's Mansion. Do suddenly they become less interested in redistricting reform? And I think that's a very good. Dick Saslaw is not a supporter of redistricting reform. And let's
to the
be,
victor go the spoils.
Well,
I think he said.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah. And let's be just real clear about this. In the Senate, where you see a lot of all the Democrats and a lot of moderate Republicans saying they support redistricting reform, it's been essentially a free vote for them because they knew it wouldn't get out of the House. Well, if now it gets out of the House, do some of these redistricting reform advocates of the last decade suddenly find themselves in a different position? I wouldn't be surprised if that were to happen.
And there is the wild card of litigation. The federal courts are considering again the House of Delegates redistricting plan, one that's been in place now, you know, since 2011. And it is possible any decision made by the trial court using very narrow standards set by the Supreme Court, part of the remedy, if the decision of the court is adverse, particularly to the Republicans, is another round of special elections. It's not unprecedented. Mm-hmm. So there could be House of Delegates elections in 2018 concurrent with congressional elections and a United States Senate election. Then 2019 rolls around. Not only is the House to be decided again, the Senate must be decided. Those districts are 2.5 times the size of House districts, and it's the 2019 election that will really sort of set the table for the 2021 redistricting. I've always sort of been intrigued by redistricting. It's the ultimate insider's game, but one of the things that I found fascinating, particularly in the past year or two, that as obtuse and arcane as it is, the consequences of these cooked districts register with more and more ordinary people. And I'm sure we've all been to these events where a candidate will make some throwaway reference to cleaning up the process by which boundaries are drawn, and the crowd goes wild. So it's taken a while, but it's seeped in to the body politic.
For people of color and other minorities, redistricting is a core issue. The Democratic Party cannot afford to, even if they have control of all three branches, to not address the issue and make it a priority. And because even though they would be in control, there are still districts that are wonky as it relates to the demographics of those regions. And that has a lot to do with getting out the vote for people of color, and really for college students as well, given how some of those districts are drawn. And so I expect it to be a continuing issue, and I expect the Democrats, whether they're in control or not, in a few years, to actually make at least talk about it, because it's an issue that they know is on the minds of a core base of theirs.
Well, the number of minority districts is not going to shrink. Federal law guarantees that. Mm-hmm. And that's important. And frankly, I would argue that it's because of that voting rights, if you will, complexity. Mm-hmm. If there were even, forgive me for putting it this way, fair and balanced redistricting in Virginia now, there still might be a House of Delegates with a slight Republican majority, maybe not as lopsided as it is, because the allowances that are made to draw those minority districts are not permissible when it comes to drawing all those other districts. That creates opportunities for the Republicans.
Just to give you a sense of redistricting actually is playing a role in the elections we just had. There is a district in Fredericksburg that is undecided. There's a court case going on about it right now. And at the core issue of this is three precincts that were split, which is one of the things that redistricting reform advocates hate. They were split, and there's some question about whether voters got the wrong ballots in these split districts. And there's this. What brought this to everyone's attention is a husband and wife who, talking about the election on Tuesday evening over dinner, and realized that they had different ballots. And so amazingly, either that house was split right down the middle, or there's a mistake. And so people point to that particular case and say, look, this is a problem with redistricting, and the way we do it is that we've got precincts here that are split. They shouldn't be split like this, and these are the problems that come with this.
And it's not just anyone's district.
And it's not just anyone's district. It's Speaker Howell's district.
Well, the turnout suggests from the last election, just in general, I don't think most voters For example, know that the state legislature draws district lines for congressional seats. I want to make that clear. And I think that in general, given the if last week's election has any potential to last beyond the momentum lasts through next year, then I think that the redistricting issue is going to stay on the agenda.
And Virginia could pick up another congressional seat. That's going to create a fourth congressional seat for Northern Virginia. That's going to put enormous pressure on the rest of the state, and some of these very odd-looking districts could suddenly become much more compact and perhaps far more competitive.
This is purely speculative, but I got a lot of index cards with the question. Which Republican legislators, if any, in the House or Senate go to the Northern administration to make room for a possible Democratic majority?
Game. The name I'm hearing all over the place is Frank Wagner, who is a state senator from Virginia Beach in an area where Democrats picked up a couple of seats in this last round of in this last election. So everybody's talking about him to transportation. Whether that happens or not, that's just what I'm hearing these days.
What's the word on the street?
To be honest, I haven't heard much about those transition predictions yet, other than with Frank, actually, and so from some colleagues at a VCU. And so I think that it's really up in the air for Northam. He just today announced some of his senior leadership team, just yesterday announced the transition. And so I think that, he has some time before he has to kind of make those decisions, and I think that's good for Republicans like Frank, because then they can use that time to try to suggest to the governor-elect that they might be interested.
Well, it strikes you as a very cynical gesture, potentially a very cynical gesture. It is, and it's been used to great effect. Republican Governor Jim Gilmore used it to destabilize very slender Democratic majorities in the House and the Senate, and starting in 1998, and that Republicans, having done this, are aware that it could be done to them. I think it's not without its advantages for the new governor. It sort of keeps the body opposite off balance for a while, and there's probably a point or two that can help Northam with that.
We've got just a couple minutes left, so let's call this a lightning round question. Some people in the audience asked some version of this question, but how will GOP members who narrowly kept their seats, living in the purpling parts of Virginia, how do you think they might govern differently?
Or legislate differently.
Or legislate, yes.
Well, I would imagine that they'll be more cautious and more risk averse in terms of controversial legislation that is, so for example, extremely socially conservative legislation, I don't think we're going to see a lot of that in this session because the Democrats have more votes and they're not going to be interested in that kind of legislation. And I think the Republicans would like to not put targets on their backs any more than they have to. And so I think that's one way we're going to see it is we're not going to see, and we haven't over the last couple of sessions.
In general, I think that the GOP is going to stick to their base. Across the country, if Virginia is any indication, in the last couple of years, you're right, they've some cases, some have shifted somewhat mainstream on some key issues. But other than social conservative issues that I do think they're going to probably largely scrap, I think on every other issue, they want to stick to their base. The message is very clear in the GOP party that the base works for them, and they don't really know what else works at this point.
You got a sentence or two, Jeff?
There are very few Republicans who fit that description. There's really only one, Tim Hugo, who's the chairman of the House Republican Caucus from Fairfax, and talk about a tortured district. So he's going to have his hands full.
And we are out of time. Thank you for joining us for the WCVE Political Forum. Thanks to Jeff, Quentin, and Ravi. Thanks to our audience. Good night.